In the theologically conservative Protestant Christianity of my childhood, the sacred was always imagined as masculine. God the Father, the Almighty. Lord, not Lady, Jesus Christ, the Son, both of whom were represented on earth by an all-male clergy. As I grew older and learned more about other Christian traditions, such as Roman Catholicism, I was fascinated by their devotion to Mary, the mother of Jesus. And although she was in some senses a feminine image of the divine, there remained the issue of her supposedly perpetual virginity, that women could only be sacred images if they were sexless. What a setup for unnatural gender dynamics for those of us here on earth. A single father, who is divine, has an encounter with a human woman who remains a virgin, but together they have a son who is said to be both fully human and fully divine. And that son, though, is supposed to be our model, but he remains celibate for his entire life. Not exactly a model for so-called traditional family values. And I remain convinced that anyone who thinks that there is a biblical vision for family values that is a man and a woman and 2.5 children has only read the Bible through a highly selective lens. Maybe one man and 800 women, and anyway. Either this summer or this fall, I will teach the first of a six-session class. I'll probably do it over the course of 4 years to eventually get to 20 sessions total on banned questions about the Bible, in which I'll go into many more details. But for this morning, allow me to share just one of the many surprising discoveries that I found as I started to read the Bible closely for myself. While reading through 1 and 2 Kings, I noticed six different passages that referred to Asherah, a name that was previously unfamiliar to me. Now, we're about to get a little nerdy here, but hang with me. The first of these six references, 1 Kings 15:13, says, "He also removed his mother Maacah from being queen mother because she had made an abominable image for Asherah. So Asa cut down her image and burned it." Who is this Asherah, I was wondering, that the queen mother is getting in so much trouble for worshiping? Then 1 Kings 18:19, "Have all of Israel assemble for me at Mount Carmel with the 450 prophets of Baal and the 400 prophets of Asherah." Now, I'd heard of Baal, but who was this Asherah who also has 400 prophets? Third, 2 Kings 21:7, "The carved image of Asherah that he had made, he set in the house that the Lord said to David and to his son Solomon, 'In this house and in Jerusalem, which I have chosen out of all the tribes of Israel, I will put my name forever.'" Wait, so now there's an image of Asherah in the Jerusalem temple? In the final three passages, you'll start to see increasingly strong pushback. 2 Kings 23:4, "The king commanded the high priest to bring out of the Jerusalem temple of the Lord all the vessels made for Baal, for Asherah, and for all the host of heaven, and he burned them outside of Jerusalem." 2 Kings 23:6, "He brought out the image of Asherah from the house of the Lord outside of Jerusalem, burned it and beat it to dust, and threw the dust upon it and upon the graves of the common people." Keep that in mind, that it was the graves of the common people that the dust of the Asherah statues were thrown. It was the common people who were worshiping Asherah. Finally, 2 Kings 23:7, "He broke down the houses of the male temple prostitutes." The male temple prostitutes, that's another sermon, that were in the house of the Lord. That's where the male temple prostitutes hung out. And that's also where the women did the weaving for Asherah. So it turns out that Asherah is the ancient Canaanite mother goddess who was associated with living trees and with hilltop forest sanctuaries, and who could sometimes be symbolized by a wooden pole or by the image of a tree. In the congregation of my childhood, I remember learning quite a few times over the years about that story. Some of you may remember it as well in 1 Kings, which sets the 450 prophets of Baal against the prophet Elijah. As the story goes, Elijah succeeds in persuading his God, Yahweh, to miraculously light some wood. And this wood has been like soaked with water. So it's like they'll never get this wood to light. But Yahweh does miraculously light it when Elijah calls on Yahweh. So that proves, according to the Bible, according to the story, that Yahweh is a true God. But the prophets of Baal and the prophets of Asherah are unable to light their fire, which, according to the Bible, proves that they are false gods. To risk spoiling the ending, assuming it's possible to spoil the ending of a 3,000-year-old story, the reason I remember this story is the slightly traumatizing ending. Some of you may remember this as well in verse 40, where Elijah commands that all 450 of the prophets of Baal be captured, taken down to the river, and killed. And although I heard that story many times, what I never noticed prior to paying attention to what happened with all these Asherah references is that it is only the prophets of Baal who are killed. The prophets of Asherah are not mentioned. Reading between the lines, they were probably spared because her cult was widely tolerated, despite the misgivings of some purists. Taking into account the Hebrew Bible, along with many archaeological discoveries related to Asherah and references to her and other ancient Near Eastern literature, it appears that Asherah was the principal female deity in the pantheon in Canaanite pre-Israelite times, and that she was the consort of the chief male deity named El, E-L. Now, that Canaanite deity El continued to show up in many places. So when you hear the word Israel, Ale. That literally means the one who wrestles with God. But it's not Isra'i Yahweh, it's Isra'i Ale, wrestling with that high God Ale. Or Samuel, right? The prophet Samuel, the name of God is what that means literally. Or Emmanuel, many of us know that from the Messiah, right? God with us, Ale with us, that ancient Canaanite male high God whose consort was Asherah. Now, there's a much more detailed story to be told here that involves how there were four major sources called nicknamed J, E, P, and D that were woven together to make what we know of as the first four books of the Bible, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, were originally four sources who we nicknamed for short J, E, P, and D. But suffice it to say that in one of those sources, known as the J source, God is consistently referred to, if you read it in Hebrew instead of English, as Yahweh Elohim. Some of you may have noticed there's an odd thing in the Hebrew Bible where Lord is sometimes written capital L-O-R-D, and it's sometimes written in all caps. I don't know if you've ever noticed that. Sometimes it's capital L, capital O, capital R, capital D. And when it's written that way, it's for the tetragrammaton. So it's when it's a way of writing around saying the word Yahweh. So in Hebrew, there are no vowels, so it's YHWH for Yahweh. And so when you see capital L, Lord in all caps, that means it's Yahweh. And it's always written Yahweh Elohim. And so it's always that way in the J source. And in the E source, God is exclusively referred to as Elohim. And you'll see that frequently. Sometimes it's Lord God, sometimes it's just Lord. Lord God, Yahweh Elohim, Lord just Elohim. And in the E source, God is exclusively called Elohim, Lord, until Exodus 3, when according to the E source, there's this surprising, huge revelation never before known in history that Moses gets from the burning bush, that God's secret name is Yahweh. But if that would be a really big surprise to the community from which the J source came out of, because they've been calling God Yahweh since the Garden of Eden. So there's a lot, all those duplicates, if you read through the Hebrew Bible, that's because there's a J source and an E source, or sometimes a P or a D. Anyway, I can say a lot more about this, but to make a long story short, the E sources emerged and have a resulting bias toward the northern kingdom of Israel. And the J stories emerge from and have a bias toward the southern kingdom of Judah. In 722 BCE, so 700 years before Jesus, the kingdom of Assyria destroyed the northern kingdom of Israel. That's why we don't have Israelites anymore. There was only the southern kingdom of Judah. That's why we went to the Jews. So we had the ancient Hebrews, then the kingdom of Israel. Assyria destroyed it in 722, just had Judah. Then we have the Jews. Then that got destroyed. Now we have Israelis, right? Okay. So eventually J and E were edited together after Assyria destroyed Israel, preserving both traditions in the wake of that tragic, catastrophic destruction of the Northern Kingdom. Over time, Yahweh, who was originally one among many ancient Canaanite tribal gods, rises so much in popularity that his identity merges and becomes one with El, so that Yahweh and El are seen as the same person, as synonymous. The chief male deity in the Canaanite pantheon becomes the one true God in Israel. But even with Yahweh's ascent among elite individuals who are responsible for the editing and the writing of the Hebrew Bible, keep in mind that like less than 5% of the population was literate at that time, the text retains trace evidence of popular devotion among the Israelite people to the ancient Canaanite mother goddess Asherah. If you're interested in going into more depth, the most accessible introduction to this topic I have found is called Did God Have a Wife? Archaeology and Folk Religion in Ancient Israel. It's by the renowned biblical archaeologist William Daver. Daver does an excellent job of emphasizing the difference between the after-the-fact, highly selective, idealistic, selective version of Israel's history that was written down by the literary and priestly elites. And that's the final version of the Hebrew Bible that we have today, that we've inherited. And we can he contrasts that, though, with the much messier and much more diverse reality, which is very clear in the archaeological record, of how religion was actually practiced among most common folk, which included widespread devotion to the goddess Asherah. So we find a whole lot of, you know, examples of these little statues with wide hips and breasts, right? So that's how we know it's Asherah, one of many reasons. So you can think about the parallel between the written version of the Hebrew Bible written by the scribal and priestly elite versus what people actually did. Think about if all someone knew about Unitarian Universalism was just sermons and just like official news releases of Unitarian Universalism, but versus what we all know is, you know, our actual lives, which fall short of the ideal. That's the difference between the, you know, official version of the Hebrew Bible, this idealistic account, versus the reality that archaeology and other sources turn up. To give just three more brief examples of how the Hebrew Bible testifies to the polytheism of many common people prior to the Babylonian exile, so that's about 586, 587 BCE. So Assyrians destroy Israel in 722. Judah is taken into exile in 586, 587. In Exodus 20, verse 3, we have God telling the Israelites, newly freed from slavery in Egypt, "You shall have no other gods before me." Not a denial that other gods exist, merely a prohibition from putting them before Yahweh. So the difference there is henotheism versus monotheism. Henotheism means there are many gods and this one's the best. Monotheism means there is only one God, no other. So like henos comes from the Hebrew word for one, as in 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Monos means single. Like if you know the there's a distinction there in Hebrew. So similarly, to give the second of three quick examples, Deuteronomy 32, 8 through 9 says, "When the Most High appointed the nations, when he divided humankind, he fixed the boundaries of the people according to the number of gods." Plural. "The Lord's own portion was his people, Jacob his allotted share." Jacob, whose name after wrestling with God becomes Israel. Again, the existence of other gods is clear. Likewise, in Joshua 24, verse 2, Joshua says to the Israelites, "Choose this day whom you will serve, whether the gods of your ancestors served in the region beyond the river or the gods of the Amorites in whose land you are living. But as for me and my household, we choose to serve the Lord," Yahweh, or actually Elohim there. So it's not a fall from this perfect past of pure monotheism. It's actually a diverse polytheism that became a idealized monotheism in the written text. And so in considering the consequences of this move from polytheism that included both male gods and female goddesses to a monotheism that says there is only one true God who is gendered male, a good general rule of thumb in religious studies is that a religion has crossed into dangerous patriarchal fundamentalism when the sacred masculine archetype of Father Sky, of looking up and in wonder at this cosmos, at this 13.7 billion year old universe story and billions of galaxies and stars, looking up in awe and wonder at that, which is meant to balance the sacred feminine metaphor and archetype of Mother Earth, that you've crossed over into dangerous patriarchal territory when that Father Sky devolves into a literal sky father. The worship of a Zeus-like male figure who is imagined literally to live in the sky and to sit in judgment of humanity. Whenever a literal sky father theology reigns, men are the beneficiaries. I know this is shocking to all of you, this revelation. And don't be fooled by the propaganda that, oh, well, we cloister our women at home and we don't allow them to drive cars and we keep their bodies covered because we respect them so much. We want to protect them. We put them up on a pedestal. As the late feminist theologian Mary Daly often said, where God is male, male is God. Or to consider the parallel of my favorite underreported belief in Mormon theology, according to the official doctrine of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, God, Heavenly Father, is married. And my hope is that Heavenly Mother, who isn't talked about that much, will continue to embolden feminists within Mormonism. In all seriousness, one of my favorite anecdotes related to this is in 1977, during the Mormon General Conference, an organization called Mormons for the Equal Rights Amendment hired a plane to fly a banner over the Salt Lake City LDS Tabernacle that said, "Mother in Heaven supports ERA." So in the spirit of Asherah, of Heavenly Mother, and of the archetype of Mother Earth, I will end with a challenge of a vision, really, from the feminist philosopher of religion, Grace Yanston. Words that feel particularly resonant in this holiday season, when a domestic terrorist attack was committed against a Planned Parenthood facility 2 days before the first Sunday in Advent, which in the Christian tradition is the four-week season of preparation for the Feast of Christmas. Yanston writes that a traditional philosophy of religion and of Western culture generally is preoccupied with violence, with sacrifice, with death, and it is built upon mortality as a human, not only as a human fact, but as a fundamental philosophical category. So she's saying, take a step back and think about what that means, that religion, traditionally in Western culture, is based fundamentally upon violence, sacrifice, and death. And she says, but what if we were to begin instead with birth? And with the hope and the possibility and the wonder implicit in it. How if we were to treat natality and the emergence of life and life in this world with the same philosophical seriousness and respect which has traditionally been paid only to mortality and to the striving for other worlds? Such a feminist approach is philosophically viable and opens up new ways of considering religion, human flourishing, identity, difference, and ecological concern. We began this morning by singing, "Just as long as I have breath, I must answer yes to life. Life here and now in this world." Let us now sing together a celebration of all the joys and sorrows, all the hope, the possibility, and wonder of this one life that we share on this one earth. Please rise in body or spirit as we sing together hymn 354, "We Laugh, We Cry."
Thank you. as we prepare to go, I'll share with you just one final thought. I've been doing this ministry thing full time for about a decade and a half now, I guess. And one of the things that saddens me really about the state of religion in our country that I see sort of a recurring motif in pastoral care situations is that, you know, over the time, quite a few people have come into my office and led with, I'm not sure if it's okay to bring this up in church, you know, could have been a religious setting. And part of what one of the underlying messages of my sermon this morning is that religion, when it's healthy, should be about all of life, that there are too many religious communities in this country in which people feel like, you know, there's no room for my gender here or the fullness of my gender. There's no place here for the fullness of my sexuality or the fullness of what I feel or what I know in my brain. And what we're trying to do here is, and other religiously progressive communities, is to say, no, this is about, what we're trying to do here is about the fullness of our lives and about the fullness of life on this earth for all people. And if you know of people who might find this way of being religious to be life-giving for them, then I invite you to, you know, if there are friends or family or colleagues that you know might find this place to be good news, I invite you to invite them to come with you one Sunday. The holiday season is often a time when people are open to seeking a new religious community or looking for hope and in the midst of a dark time. So, and Christmas Eve is also a good time. We'll have two services here, identical. Our choir will be singing. We're going to have amazing music. It'll be at 5 o'clock and 7 o'clock, identical services on Christmas Eve. Come to both, whatever you're into. We'll all be coming to both, right? So as you go from this place, continue your journey walking in love. Care for one another and care for this one earth. Do justice and make peace. And as you go, whatever taste or touch you've had in this time and place of hope, of love, of peace or joy, that goes with you out into the world. So live boldly and with thanksgiving. Go in peace.